This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
Very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the week's top stories that they've been covering on their financial website of the year. Now, firstly, inflation jumped to its highest level in 2 years, hitting spenders and savers alike. Can we blame Brexit?
Headline rate shot up, but a lot of that was to do with clothing. And clothing is like a yo-yo. It goes up 1 month, comes down the next month.
Well, you can blame Brexit if you're the chief exec of Ryanair and you want to squeeze more money from your passengers.
I'm not particularly surprised with Ryanair because they do have a tendency to add these little extra costs on, which are very irritating.
What little trick do they have up their sleeve this time? Also today, just how secure is your bank account?
Historically, banks have taken a very archaic approach to onboarding customers.
But just who is the worst offender at looking after your details? We take a look at the Treasury's U-turn to allow retired savers to cash in their annuities.
When you make things more complicated, you almost always create new unfairnesses, new boundary lines, new people saying, hang on a minute, I'm just the wrong side of that line you've just created.
So as savers continue to get hammered by politicians, scammers, inflation and continuing current account cuts, Simon reckons, well, they need a break of the tax variety. And when is a fiver worth over a grand? When a reality TV star pays that for one. But we are asking, with all the additional costs for flights, is it time we just ditch all the confusing add-ons and have one flat fee? Or are you one of those people who just doesn't care where they sit, you don't take your luggage on, and you can easily book and print off your tickets whenever is convenient for the airline to do so? So are budget airlines as well budget anymore? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rachel.
Hello, Georgie.
Simon, to you first. Is it time just to ditch all the confusing add-ons, one flat fee?
Well, if it meant paying 20 quid more for your ticket, for example, then I'd object to paying 20 quid more for my ticket, to be perfectly honest. My thing with the budget airlines has always been, as long as you play by the rules, you don't have to pay.
But the rules keep changing,
Simon.
Yeah,
the rules do keep changing and the rules are stupid. I wouldn't disagree with that. But as long as you can continue to play by them, then you can do so. However, if were I to turn up to an airport and be told I was going to have to pay some stupendous amount of money because I'd lost my boarding pass or something, I'd be very grumpy about it. Obviously, as a parent, it does matter to me where I sit because we need to sit together. Now, Ryanair and EasyJet have kind of changed things around a bit now so that you get allocated seating, whereas in the past you didn't. And I actually think that one of the reasons behind the allocated seating EasyJet brought in first was actually due to the problems that it was causing by people not having allocated seating, then trying to sit next to their friends and their family. And you'd get on a plane and the plane would be delayed taking off because nobody will sit down because they're muddling around the place trying to find places for their bags, trying to find places for their family. But we had it where we got on the plane and we were on basically at the end of the queue with the kids and there wasn't anywhere for us to all sit together. And we said to one of the stewardesses, we need to, you know, find somewhere to sit with the kids. It's like, we don't have to all sit together. We just each need to be next to a kid. And one of the stewardesses said, well, I've found two seats and there's one behind the other. And I was like, yeah, she's three. She can't sit behind me. She needs to sit next to me. But I refuse to pay to choose my seats. I think that basically if you're flying with kids, it's the airline's responsibility to make sure that you can sit next to your kids. And I don't think that parents should be made to pay to choose their seats in order to be able to sit next to their children when their children are too young to not be able to sit next to them. Fine, when you get kids get to like 10, 11, 12, if they have to sit somewhere else, they have to sit somewhere else. But when it's young kids, I don't think parents should have to pay.
I agree with you on that, but I also agree on a flat fee because I am always the person that does, it does matter where I sit on the plane. I do take a lot of luggage wherever I go. I can't easily book things and print them off. So very selfishly, I think a flat fee. Rachel, for you, good morning.
Good morning. This is a tricky one. I was on a flight last month to Venice on Ryanair. I was queuing up with my app held out ready to go and then behind me there was a woman who was maybe in her 60s who had just been charged 45 quid because she wasn't able to print her boarding pass in advance. She got to the airport and they said, oh, don't worry, we'll sort it out, you just need to download the app. She said, I don't know what you're talking about, but here's my phone. And they downloaded it for her And then they said, oh, sorry, since you've already checked in before we downloaded the app won't work, so you're going to have to pay £45. It seems so unfair. But what we have seen is this sort of cross-subsidisation of people like me with people like her. So I will always print my boarding pass in advance. I travel with hand luggage. I don't care where I sit. I would just rather pay the absolute minimum. And it means that I end up paying next to nothing to fly. The people who do end up paying more, I think, as subsidising me, are people who are older, who don't have the app, who don't want to queue for ages, and so want to be able to get on the plane first, who perhaps have, you know, medical things that they, or more stuff, maybe they have kids, so they have to check in luggage. It does seem an unfair imbalance here. So in theory, I think, yes, we should pay a flat fee, but if I did have to pay 20 quid, I'd be really angry and I'd probably switch to another airline. So I don't know.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, weekdays from 9 till 12, wants your feedback. Contact the programme by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
It does indeed. A very warm welcome. This is Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year. This is Money, back in the studio with me, joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. I did promise we'd talk more about Ryanair, which we will, but first, some bad news for consumers this week as the price of anything from petrol to high street fashions and electrical goods set to go up. Inflation jumped to its highest level in 2 years. CPI from 0.6% to 1%. Is Share Radio's very own Laurie Laird.
It wasn't that long ago that we were talking about deflation, and we were wondering whether the Bank of England had enough ammunition left to fight deflation. And now we're looking at inflation. Look, inflation's not running ahead. We're at an annual rate of 1.0%. That's still only half of the Bank of England's target, but it looks like it's only going one way. This inflation number was a lot higher than anyone expected, including the Bank of England. The thing that really struck me about the numbers today is that the big rise, the big increase to CPI was clothing and footwear. And the statistician who looks after these numbers said that there was no explicit evidence of the weakness in sterling feeding through to those numbers. He put it down to irregular discounting. Years ago, we would have certain discounts at certain times of the year, but now clothing retailers spread those out throughout the year, so it's harder to pick those up. But we haven't seen any sterling effect, really, in this increase in inflation. So that means there's a lot more coming.
There's a lot more coming. You mean we can't blame Brexit? No, says Pete Comley, author of Inflation Matters.
I think there's comparatively little impact of Brexit in these numbers. I mean, headline rate shot up, but a lot of that, half of that increase, was to do with clothing. And clothing, as we've talked about many times before, is like a yo-yo. It goes up one month, comes down the next month. It's actually an incredibly difficult thing for ONS to measure, which is why we end up with these gyrations in the number. And I think the price of clothing, according to ONS, is exactly the same now as it was 5 years ago. And it's a bit like airfares. Neither of them are really helpful for understanding the underlying trend, really. But the underlying trend is undoubtedly up. But we've yet to see Brexit, really, on this data. In the short term, we are about to see a very big, steep rise in inflation, and it's all to do with petrol prices. By Christmas, I think you'll see CPI above 1.5% heading towards 2%, and that's purely to do with petrol.
So, bad for consumers, but also we're hearing pretty bad news for savers. Yes, I know, more bad news for savers. But now they need an account paying more than that to earn a real return on their deposits, more than the 1%, but with only the very best easy access paying just 1% and fixed rate accounts slightly more. Most nest eggs are now shrinking. But could there be hope, though? An environment of rising inflation may eventually cause interest rates to move in the same direction. But first, Simon, if we can't blame Brexit, what is causing this rise in inflation and why does it matter?
Well, the issue here is that obviously inflation going up would theoretically be good news in this scenario, because we were at the point where we had no inflation, and so we were worried about deflation not that long ago. But the bad news for consumers is there's a load of price rises on the horizon. that inflation has already risen because it was going to rise anyway. But the Brexit price hikes, they haven't arrived yet. They're going to be coming down the line as basically retailers start passing on some of these costs. So things like toys, most of the toys that are bought in this country are imported. Those are probably going to get more expensive for Christmas. Fancy a bottle of wine at Christmas? That's probably going to get more expensive. Fancy eating anything that comes from outside of the country? That's probably going to get more expensive.
English wine is very good, though.
English wine is very good. English wine is also expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say it's also very expensive so as well.
I'm not sure you'd save any money.
No.
But, you know, this is the reality of the pound falling substantially against the dollar and against the euro. Unfortunately, we talked about this last week, about the savings crunch that was coming. So I'd written about it in my column, and the fact that the best easy access savings rate and the inflation rate, the line of them was, they were about to meet, if you looked at the chart. It didn't take long for that meeting to happen, did it? I didn't necessarily expect it to happen in the very next week, because this inflation figure was slightly higher than people expected. But it's a squeeze, and it's going to hit people. But as long as, you know, if inflation goes to 3%, that's not that bad. You know, it's if it starts going up above that level. You know, at the moment there's forecasts it could go to 3, maybe it could go to 4. If it starts going to 4 or 5, and then sticks there, that's when people need to be worried.
Well, I heard someone say it's like Marmite, you either love it or you hate it, which links us nicely onto, actually, there are fears, and one of those fears is how people are going to cope, Rachel, with rising inflation, came from the UK boss of Tesco, voicing concern about the impact of high prices, particularly on those on a tight budget, warning that food price inflation could prove highly toxic for shoppers, potentially lethal for millions of people struggling to live from week to week. Is this something that you think is correct?
There's two variables with inflation. There's how much everything costs, and there's how much money we've got. If wage inflation keeps up with the cost of products going up, services going up as well, it's not really a problem. Everyone will just about manage with it. If we don't see wages go up, but we continue to see the price of stuff go up, that will become more problematic. Tesco boss would say that, wouldn't he? And they are really in a bind, Tesco, and really all of those retailers, because we've become so price conscious. I suppose with Aldi and Lidl, with the financial crisis, we started to look a lot more at what we're spending. And you can check the price of stuff so easily. Gone are the days where you just go to Tesco once a week and buy the same old stuff at whatever price it was. Now you shop round and you can stand in Tesco and see what you'd get, what you'd have to pay at Sainsbury's. So it's going to be very hard for Tesco to pass on any kind of price increases to their customers. And we've seen that with the spat with Unilever. And it makes sense that the boss of Tesco's would be issuing this kind of gloomy warning to prepare us for what they obviously want to do.
Well, that's it. It's a preparation, isn't it? I mean, we were reading this morning, and I rather like some of the headlines on this. Two fingers to the public as Kit Kat could raise their prices. That's, of course, Nestle. But is this inevitable? And Tesco sort of positioning themselves as, we did what we could, we fought so hard, but it just can't be helped. Do you think that's a...
They really need to come up with a very good story to put up prices, because there's still Aldi and Lidl, they're still fighting that battle now. I don't know really that, I mean, boss of Tesco said that we could have, I think, 5% inflation growth every year. But we've had one of the big contributors to low inflation over the past few months, or maybe longer, has been the falling price of food. So we've been having... We're going from a very low benchmark. So even if we had increases of 5%, it would be sort of a bit tough to say that that would be the thing that would push families over the edge.
In terms of inflation figures, I mean, we heard Pete speaking a little bit earlier, didn't we, Simon, about, you know, are airfares and clothing prices really the best way to measure inflation? And this is all about, he's saying, well, petrol is going to be significant.
Yeah, it makes you think maybe we should take clothing and airfares out of the basket of goods. But then if you started taking all of the things out of the basket of goods that have the potential to skew inflation, you'd end up with a fairly empty basket, wouldn't you?
So then what's the point in the figure anyway?
Well, I mean, the difficulty with the inflation figure, of course, is that this basket of goods is what's judged to be, you know, the average shop, the average person's spending. It's not the average shop, it's the average person's spending. But nobody's really the average person. It's like the average house price. Nobody really has the average house. You might have a house that looks like the average house, but it probably doesn't cost the same as the average house. And so my inflation rate would be different from your inflation rate, would be different from a pensioner's inflation rate, would be different from a student's inflation rate. But unless you measure these things with some form of benchmark, then it's very difficult to track how things are changing. So essentially, the CPI inflation is just a best guess of how much the cost of living is rising at, and it doesn't really reflect your own cost of living at all. I mean, I know certainly that, as Rachel said, we've benefited quite substantially over the last couple of years from a number of things that were proving to be very expensive for people getting cheaper. So there were concerns about, I mean, we don't pay that much for food in this country, but there were concerns about like how much of a chunk of the bill food was taking up, because food prices were rising at a fair clip not so long ago. Petrol was very expensive. Our energy bills were constantly going up. And we've seen a freeze in all of those things, or a price fall in them. So, you know, it's cheaper to fill your car up. People's energy bills have actually fallen. And then they have just stuck and not gone anywhere. But there's going to come a time where those things start going up again. And I think possibly because they have been falling or they have been frozen, it's probably going to feel like it hurts us a little bit more.
We were talking there about shopping by and large and our bills. Rachel, what about savers? I mentioned a little bit earlier. Bad news for them?
Yeah, we thought it couldn't get worse. And here we are. It is almost impossible now to have your money in a savings account and for it not to be shrinking. So the two numbers you have to look at are the rate that you're getting, your interest rate, and the rate of inflation. And if the former is bigger than the latter, you're okay. The other way around, your nest egg will be eroded. And 1% now is a good rate to be getting on a savings rate. And there used to at least be a few little tricks that savers could get up to, moving money into current accounts, things like that, having cracked down there as well. So bad news for savers, good news for borrowers still.
And it's interesting you said there about switching to current accounts, and there is a bloodbath, I think is what you've called it, on This Is Money. No mincing of words there. And speaking of vanishing returns due to inflation, well, the good news is we were reading this week that a lot of FedUp customers have been upping sticks and switching. Vast majority, though, as Rachel mentioned, tempted by the attractive interest rates and reward schemes attached to the four banking giants' flagship current accounts. How are we rewarded for our switching efforts? Well, even more huge cuts, and there is no end in sight. The first comes in less than 2 weeks' time, when Santander halves the rate on its popular 123 account for some 170,000 of its customers. So, Rachel, the rate cuts continue, no end in sight. Halifax, TSB, Lloyds all saying they'll be doing the same early next year.
Yeah, the sad thing is a lot of them have halved the rates on their current accounts, but they're still quite good deals. And they'll still probably draw in people because they still are a good alternative to a savings account. So we've seen 170,000 bank customers who have gone to current accounts at Santander, Halifax, Lloyds and TSB, and now their rates are going to be cut. It was always a bit peculiar in the first place that you'd get a better return on your current account than you would on your savings account. But banks don't really seem to want people's savings at the moment. They can get money to lend out to people elsewhere for much cheaper. But they still want current account customers, because if you get one of them in the door, you can sell them all sorts of other stuff that they may or may not want. You know, you can try and sell them a loan, or you can try and give them a credit card, or all these different things. Captive audience, much more engaged than someone with a savings account with your bank. So they were still trying to get in customers with these deals that were very attractive. And now they can probably still lure people in because the rates are still better than they would get on current accounts. Maybe not to the same numbers. Maybe they're sort of reaching the point at which they feel like they're reaching the numbers that they want.
Well, I'm just thinking, these are the switches. Talk about if you can lure these people in some, and you've got them for life. And incidentally, I phoned up my bank today on security measures, and I'll explain that in a short while. But they said, Miss Frost, today is your 15-year anniversary. Thank you for your custom. It shows once you've got them in, you can really keep them. them there, especially if you're me. But these are the switchers. These are the ones that want to move around. So naturally, they're going to move again if they keep getting their rates cut. But like you say, and like Rachel says, still pretty good compared to what else you can get out there.
Could I just ask, did your bank give you anything for that 15
that.
Years? Was there just a congratulations?
It was just a thank you for your custom.
Thanks.
I know.
Thanks.
Afterwards, when I put the phone down, I thought, you know, I should have asked, are you going to give me some sort of money or a better deal? But then I thought, no, come on, let's be British and thank them for thanking me for my custom.
If I was your bank and I was going to flag that up, I mean, maybe you was just speaking to a nice person on the phone who just noticed the date,
probably.
Basically. I'd have given you a tenner. I'd have said, here you go, here's a tenner.
Would you?
Basically, yeah.
Would you give money to a customer that you're pretty guaranteed not to lose in the next 15 years?
Well, because you've made so much money off them over the last 15 years, you might as well give them a tenner. I think that there is some irony in the fact that...
You're listening, HSBC. Yes.
Yes, HSBC, you owe Georgie Frost £10. Actually, you should give her 15.
Thank
15
you.
Years,
Thank
15
you,
pounds.
Come yeah. on, yeah.
Now, there's an idea for the banks, isn't there? Why don't banks reward you for your loyalty mm-hmm. by giving you that number in pounds every year that you pass your bank anniversary? So once you've done, you know, 5 years, you get a fiver, 6 years, yep. 6 quid, and you do it every year.
Put it into a savings account for you, so it gets you saving as well.
Yeah.
There's so many
benefits. And you could earn 1% interest on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you had a Best Buy savings account. If you just had any old run-of-the-mill savings account, you'd probably get maybe 0.25%.
Yeah. Or an additional 0.1% for every year you've been there. So I would get like 1.5%, which would be all right, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, actually, Nationwide has the Loyalty Saver account. And I can't remember what the rate on my Loyalty Saver account is now. But I think I qualify for the 10-year Loyalty Saver account. Basically, the interest rate is bordering on an insult.
I think that's when we'll know that the savings market is working. Note that, CMA.
Yep.
It will be working when you get a bonus for every year that you've been with your bank.
There you go, when we rule the world. I can't even remember what I asked
you were
you,
asking
Simon.
Me about people switching and whether they'll just switch again and then pointing out that it wasn't going to affect you anytime soon. There is a great irony in the fact that the people who actually did what they were told and switched banks then promptly got their rate cut. However, you cannot ignore the fact that all the people who didn't do what they were told and didn't switch banks will not have had their rate cut, but that's because they won't be getting a rate in the first place. They'll still be sat on their old legacy current account that probably isn't doing them any favours at all, not paying them any money, not paying them any interest, not giving them any perks, and certainly not giving them a pound for every year they've been a customer. So, yes, those people might switch again, although, as we've shown with inertia, they probably won't. It's not just about money, it's about customer service and things as well. And so the fact of the matter remains that the rates on those accounts are still better than the rates that you would get on savings, and the banks know that, and that is why they have felt comfortable cutting. And I think that we are seeing a bit of an end of the great race for current account customers, perhaps, at the moment.
Do you think that that's it? Are they going to keep cutting? Because they can. They've got plenty of a way to cut.
Yeah, but also they don't want us to hate them. There is a sort of price to put on goodwill, and if Santander were to do it again, that their account is so high profile, people so upset the first time that they did it, do it again. They've really had to struggle over the past few years to get their levels of goodwill back. Santander, would they backtrack on that? Is it worth it? I don't know.
Yeah, Rachel's right. Rachel's right there, I think, because you've got to remember these are flagship products, aren't they? And it's really obvious when they cut the rate. Not in the same way that it is with your savings account. They can get away with constantly hacking away at your savings account. I mean, some of them have launched flagship savings products in the past. They certainly don't launch any flagship savings products now. But you can still get away with cutting the rate because not that many people notice. But these current accounts, yeah, people notice, and it's bad publicity. And so you don't want to be hacking back at those rates. So I think we'll see these cuts, and then they'll stick there for a while. And then you'd have to see something like another major rate cut or another major step down in sort of the money markets before you saw more cuts, I think. And I'm not so sure that we're going to get that.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome, editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from This Is Money here with me. Now, we spoke about switching there. If you are switching, there are things that you definitely want to ask yourself and of your bank. And up there is, Well, how secure is my bank? The consumer group, which has slammed four high street giants for consistently scoring badly when it comes to security measures for current account customers. The worst offender, TSB. The results come as bank fraud booms. Here's Jeremy Newman, the founder and executive director at software startup ShowUp.
Well, there was a study done called the Annual Fraud Indicator 2016, and that measured all fraud at about £193 billion a year. But the largest fraud against individuals is identity fraud, measured at about £5.4 billion a year. But really, identity fraud is more than just that particular point. Half of all fraud has at its root some form of identity fraud. In other words, people often commit crimes under false identities. This is the sort of elephant in the room of e-commerce and indeed all online banking, is that if an organization is asking you for a password or other memorable information, whatever it is, for verification purposes, they're unable to tell the difference between their customer and an imposter.
Well, here's Tony Neat from Get Safe Online.
I really wonder why it's costing £11 billion. There's so many things that we can do to put that right, and it doesn't have to be complicated. You know, the average loss is £210 to people. That's an extraordinary amount of money, and just taking the basics, we could be all a lot safer. What we're seeing in relation to the types of crime is everything and anything, really, from phishing emails to identity theft, to people phoning you up, making out that they're from a security company. The information that we put on social media without closing our privacy settings down, it's all giving the criminals more access to us so they can deprive us of that our hard-earned money or even the information that we've got. I think people don't realise when they've been conned online. I think people who are sometimes think it's not worth reporting. A lot of people don't recognise it as a cyber crime, something that can be reported. But it is very important that they do report it. Report it to their banks, report it to the other financial institutions, report it to the police. But put in the necessary safeguards to make sure it doesn't happen to them again.
That was Tony Neat there from Get Safe Online. As fraud and cybercrime costing the UK nearly £11 billion in the last year. So it's bad out there. And the banks, some of them, aren't stepping up much to help. So which are the safest? But before we ask that, indeed, what makes a bank safe or not, Rachel? Which was taking a look at this, and they have done for the last 4 years.
They have, and they've ranked online banking security levels of the 11 top banks on four different criteria, including the login, encryption, account management, navigation and logout. It's unclear to me actually whether this is a kind of crude way of comparing them all. And certainly the banks that fared poorest will point out some sort of issues with the methodology. But it's a good place to start. And what it does that's useful is it gets, I hope, gets people thinking about the security levels on their bank accounts. The thing that you don't really ask yourself, we compare rates, customer service, but do we really think about how secure their systems are? The banks are in a bit of a bind because there's sort of two main variables. There's the security, and then almost opposed to that is ease. So you can... probably the safest account would be one that requires you to have the most obscure passwords, three of them, some kind of online device, you know, little chip reader thing, and then you get a message on your phone. That would be really secure. No one would use it and they'd hate it and they'd probably never bank. So they have to come up with something in between. And indeed, if Which did some kind of investigation into the ease of use of their of online banking systems of banks, perhaps they'd end up with the same list in reverse. So they have to sort of combine the two. And one of the things that Which got upset about were the banks that didn't have this two-step verification process, which is good in that it's more secure.
Two-step meaning you have to sign in and then it sends a note to perhaps
your phone, or the chip reader thing or whatever it is. It's really annoying. Simon will tell you about the payments that he has delayed making because it happens to all of us. You don't have your little chip reader on you at the right time, and so then you have to do it another time and forget.
Eye scanners, that's what we need, isn't it? Or some bio.
Well, that's what they're all investing in now. Sort of bio whatevers, and you'll probably be, oh, another one that they're doing, I've forgotten which bank it is, that they're listening out now to the background noise on your phone call to see if it sort of sounds a bit suspect or not. So all of these things to use technology, I suppose, spending a ton of money just so that they don't have to get us to do all of the work,
yeah.
Which does make sense, doesn't it? Because you'll have the early adopters will be people who are very happy using all of this technology and remembering all their passwords and things. And now as they start to close the very last of the high street banks, the ones who they really want to try and convert now to online banking are perhaps people who are older who aren't so technologically savvy, and you don't want to start giving them a ton of card readers and passwords to remember. So you really have to come up with a palatable offering for your online banking customers while making sure that those same customers who are probably most vulnerable to fraudsters aren't being ripped off. It's tricky.
Now, you say they're using technology for all sorts of reasons. One is the ease, isn't it? And Simon, you did mention there about switching and why we don't switch enough. Our own inertia has a part to play. But as I mentioned a little bit earlier, I got text this morning from Info HSBC. Click on this link, it told me. I called the bank. Eventually, they said, yes, it's fraud and they'll never ask you to click on a link. However, when I called said bank, there is a 15-minute wait on this. Were I anything else doing anything else, I would hang up and I wouldn't bother.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing about the security thing here is basically fraudsters target the weak link, and the weak link is you.
It's me.
Yeah, basically. So it's if you can you convince someone to do something that they shouldn't do? Can you get something onto their computer that puts a dummy internet banking screen, and instead of asking for a couple of letters from your password, it asks for your whole password? Now, when that happens, basically, the bank will tell you they would never ask you for your whole password, and you should know that they would never ask you for your whole password. But this happened to me a couple of years back with Nationwide. Somehow we managed to get some kind of virus that somehow got into the computer. When I went to the Nationwide internet banking page, it brought up, you know, what looked exactly like the Nationwide internet banking page. I couldn't tell the difference. And it asked me for, like, my whole password. And I was like, oh, I just thought, oh, they've just changed it. Because the problem is the banks change the login things so often that you've got to be really on top of it, not to just go, oh, they've just changed the login screen, you know. So you've got to remember that if someone asks you for your whole password, or if someone asks you for something that you think, well, hang on a minute, that doesn't seem right, stop. Like, if you get a message that says, click this link, and you think, hang on a minute, that doesn't seem right, don't click the link. So, you know, don't be the weakest link, basically.
But then you call up the bank and they tell you it's going to take 15 minutes, and you think, well, goodness me, if someone's got hold of my account, they could do havoc in 15 minutes. Quick, I must click on. Actually, they only spent two minutes answering the phone call in the end.
Well, there you go. So this two-factor identification, this is interesting because myself and Lee were talking about this yesterday. Now, Nationwide and First Direct came out really high in this because they have this two-factor identification. And the two of them do it in two different ways. So Nationwide does it with a little card reader. You put your chip and PIN card in and you have to put in your PIN number and it delivers a code. First Direct gets you to nominate. You could either choose a card reader thing or you nominate a device that's going to be your safe device. So mine's my phone, for example. Mm-hmm. And you can log into your phone, fine, do your internet banking on the app. But if you want to do something on your online banking, you have to generate a code on your phone with your password. Gives you a code, one-time only code. You've got 30 seconds to put it in. Remember to get yourself to the point where you need to put it in before you generate the code. Otherwise, you find yourself in some race against time, scrolling through screens. Must get there within 30 seconds. And then you're in.
Right.
However, both of those systems, and I know this because I bank with both of them, You can get into your account without going through that two-factor process, but what you get into is a limited version of it, so you can't do certain things. With First Direct, I think you can just see the accounts, you can't make a payment to anyone, or with Nationwide, you can't make a new payment to anyone without having done it. So that's where the protection comes in, is they're protecting you from making new payments to other people, so you couldn't make a new payment to a fraudster. But you could get in and see the information. And what's interesting here is that often, you know, if people can get past that first level of security and find some information, then they might be able to use that information to phone you up and convince you that they're your bank. And they'll say, well, you know, I've got the details of your last three transactions here. And you think, well, if they know my last three transactions, they must be my bank. So But do you want those banks to remove the ability to get into the bank account without, you know, without having to do that extra step of two-factor identification? Personally, as someone who uses the accounts, no, because it's a pain in the backside doing the two-factor identification, especially with my First Direct account, where if you want to pay a new person, even though they've decided your phone is the secure device, you have to do it on a desktop, generating a code from your phone. And as Rachel alluded to a few minutes ago, I have pointed out before that what this means is basically I just never pay anyone money if I've not paid them money before. So it takes ages. You just never get around to it.
Yeah,
exactly. Be warned, people. Basically, if I've never paid you money before, don't get me to pay you anything because it's impossible. Or just take cash.
It's all the bank's fault.
Yeah, but so I don't know. There is this real balance, as Rachel said, between ease of use and security.
Well, you talk about paying cash there, Simon, and you did also mention Lee. And it's not often that I know who a reality TV star is. And when Consumer Affairs editor Lee Boyce, who we're referring to, posted pictures on social media of himself with one, I knew that this time would be absolutely no different. The gentleman who had the pleasure of drinking coffee with our Lee was Jesse McClure. That's an American reality TV star, apparently. And for why did he have this pleasure of coffee with Lee? A fiver. A special fiver, one he paid an especially large amount of money for. Everybody's going mad for fivers, Rachel. But firstly, who is Jesse McClure? Help me out on this one.
He's, Storage Hunters, that's the one.
Right, okay.
He's on a show in the States that's having some kind of transfer to the UK where he sort of gleans out the treasures from junk. And shared...
Like cash in the attic or something?
I know how it works.
All right, okay, all right.
Right, so basically in Storage Hunters, which was Jesse McClure's old show, and now he's starting up a new show called British Treasure American Gold. But in Storage Hunters, no, it's not. They would bid blind on a shipping container full of stuff, and then they would go and sell it to make money. They'd find some real gems in there, so,
bargain,
you know.
Bargain hunt meets cash in the attic meets...
Meets a shipping container, yeah. And with the British Treasure American Gold, he's going to be finding stuff here and then taking it back over to the States and selling it in this special, you know, secondhand boutique shop that he set up in, I think, California. And obviously the British aspect of it is very attractive to people buying over there. But as you said, the reason why Jesse was talking to Lee...
We got distracted there.
...was because they had been conversing after Lee's been writing all these stories about new £5 notes and the people, you know, buying them with low serial numbers on. And there was this auction where the lowest possible serial number one was sold. But Jesse had bought not the lowest possible serial number one, but lot four, a £5 note with AA01000020.
Doesn't want that on their fiver?
Yeah, for £1,200, basically.
Right.
And that is basically number four in the line. So the one that sold for £4,150 was AA01000017. So that's number 17. All the ones before that basically go to the Queen. You can't get your hands on them. Mm-hmm. This number 20 was fourth in line after that first one you can get. And he said that he thinks that this is going to be worth serious money in years to come. And, you know, he's a man who knows his stuff. And, he says he's already had a £7,000 offer on it.
Can I just say, I have Facebook on my phone here, and they've got a marketplace aspect to their app. And just scrolling down it, we've got a fiver for £500, a few sort of like sofas and the like, four for £5,000, three for £300, two for £50. Someone's even selling a £50 note there. They've obviously not been told the rules here. £5 for £50. What on earth is going on? Fivers everywhere. How much is a fiver worth?
Whatever someone's willing to pay for.
That's
it.
A very good answer.
So at the moment, £7,000. But notes, I mean, Lee's written a lot of sort of note stories over the years, and it's very hard to find any note or coin that's worth much more than its face value, unless there are a few that are, you know, there's been some kind of glitch at the mint, and then they're worth something. But this is new on several counts. It's the first, our first polymer. It's a new fiver. All of these £5 notes that people are selling are unique in the sense that they all do have a different, it's not like you're just selling any old fiver. They all do have different registration numbers, so they are identifiable as unique purchases. But whether they'll go up in value, I've no idea. At least looking at the moment into whether the same happened in Australia when they switched over to polymers and what they're worth now. I wonder if we'll look back and think, what a load of nonsense.
I imagine we probably will. I mean, Simon, you got a fiver out, so I got my fiver out.
Fiver top trumps here. Yeah. So basically, the ones that are selling for the most money are the ones with the lowest possible serial numbers, right? Those are the collectibles. I have a £5 note here. My serial number is AE...
Ooh. I'm well off.
28...
I've lost already.
766461.
I am AJ.
Yes!
Right. but also, there are other quirks that can earn you more cash. If you have a particularly cool-sounding number, like the AK-47 just went for quite a lot, and someone was delighted to have discovered their own phone number as their serial number.
It's a bit unique, so. Though. Sure no one else will want to pay a lot of money for that.
But how much would you pay for your own? I don't know.
£5, to be honest.
I would love to see what the rest of the world currently thinks of Britain. We've got not only the sort of slight post-Brexit confusion, but loads of people running around paying more for money than money is actually worth.
Well, we'll find out with Jesse McClure's new show, won't we?
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
I have absolutely no idea how I'm going to segue from that into annuities, but we'll do it anyway. So we've spoken about inflation scammers, ruthless banks piling on the woes to long-suffering savers, but we can also add politicians to that as well. This week, the Treasury pulled back on a promise to allow retired savers to cash in their annuities, and now there are rumours the new Chancellor, Philip Hammond, will try to axe vital tax breaks for middle-class workers who are in their 30s and older that help them build up larger pensions. So many changes, it's hard to keep up.
So about a year ago, we got these lovely pension reforms, pension freedoms, which meant that in the old days, people used to buy an annuity with whatever nest egg they'd accrued. So they'd hand it all over to a company, and in return, they would get a set amount of money every year for the rest of their lives guaranteed, regardless of how long they lived for. That was all right for a while, but they started to get to be pretty poor value. And also we've seen this week evidence of mis-selling, so even poorer value on poorer value products. So pension freedoms were brought in part to mitigate this, to say, you don't have to buy these rubbish products. We trust you enough to say, do whatever you want with your pension pots. If you want to keep it invested, and just take whatever you need. And while the rest of the pot continues to grow, go ahead and do it. The fallout for this was there were a bunch of people who had already bought these rubbish products who were saying, well, what about us? We're not benefiting from pension freedoms. Some of them would have pension pots so small that when it was converted to an annuity, it would be worth just a few pounds even every month, when actually what would have been much more useful would have just been to have the lump sum straight up to spend on something that they actually needed. So the Chancellor, former Chancellor, George Osborne, said, fine, for you guys, what we're going to do is set up the secondary annuity market. And that will mean that you can trade in your old annuity. We're going to allow whatever providers want to get in on this to buy up your annuities and give you a cash sum in return. And we had this announcement this week from the new Chancellor. Well, not him, actually, it was just the Treasury said, changed our minds, sorry. You're stuck. If you've got one of those rubbish annuities, you're just going to have to keep that for life. And
is it completely off the table, or is it just the fact that, say, Philip Hammond is going, look, it's confusing enough, people are complaining, and I've got bigger fish to fry with Brexit?
It's pretty off the table and, you know, gone in the bin. The plus side of this is people wouldn't necessarily have got a good deal, that there would have been all these fees, people were arguing, middlemen taking their chunk, and then by the time you get to the end of it, is it really worth it? And the argument that they made, that the government made, which also does seem in a sense quite reasonable, that no one actually, it turned out, when they went through the consultation processes, no one actually wanted to buy these products. Mm. And if you don't have enough companies who want to buy them, then there's no competition, which means that you, pensioners are going to end up with an even worse deal. So they said, in the interests of protecting pensioners, they were taking it off the table.
Simon, your views, good news, bad news?
I think it's bad news if you've got a bad value annuity that you wanted to get rid of, and you wanted it, or you had an annuity paying you a very small sum that you thought you'd prefer to have the lump sum. And I think it's bad news because basically this was promised to people and people thought, great, I'm going to be able to do this. And then all of a sudden it's been taken away from them. I think it's good news in the sense that I actually do think that for many people, they probably, in order to sell that annuity, they would have taken such a big hit on it that it probably wouldn't have been worth them selling it. And I think it's very difficult for people to calculate what that annuity income is actually worth to them. But I think that what it illustrates is that the promise should never have been made in the first place. This was classic George Osborne shooting from the hip with some idea that he'd come up with that he thought was going to be really popular. You know, he brought in the pension freedoms, and then there was this whole thing of people who had already bought their annuities and they weren't going to get to benefit from the pension freedoms. And there was a, right, well, we're going to do something to help them. So we're going to make it so they'll be able to sell the annuities and we'll create a market for it. You know, this the market doesn't exist, so we're going to create a market. And lo and behold, we discovered that actually the market wasn't interested in creating a market. So in this instance, I think it would have been a better idea to find out whether it was feasible to create a market before promising that we were going to create one. But I can definitely understand why, if you are someone with an annuity that you've just spent the last year thinking, excellent, I'm going to be able to get shot of this soon, yeah, you discovered that the government had turned around and said, actually, no, for your own good, you're not going to be able to get shot of it. You'd be pretty peeved.
I imagine so. Well, we started with flights, Brexit, the falling pound. Just when you thought you could be squeezed no more when it came to flights, think again. We will end with that, because who else but Ryanair have uncovered another way to prize more of those pounds from our pockets. Six of them, in fact. That's if you want to check in more than 4 days in advance. And yes, they are blaming the usual Brexit suspect. Rachel, please answer this question. Why £6? Why 4 days? Arbitrary, or was there a specific reason for that?
Oh, absolutely not arbitrary, no. Ryanair did some in-depth customer research, okay, and the feedback they got from their customers was that they wanted to be charged £6. And they argue it the other way around, that apparently you can check in advance, pay for the privilege, and pick your own seat. And those people who were stumping up wanted more time to be able to pick their seats before the riffraff, who don't want to pay the £6 like me, come in and start taking them all. So to increase that window involved decreasing the window of everyone else. But their results were out this week, and they are really struggling, and they will do, because they get a lot of their fares in pounds, and the value of the pound has fallen. But also, flying remains exceptionally competitive. And you have, you know, Lee was saying that BA now won't even give you a little snack on your flights. So they also are sort of wading in on the price game. It's going to be very hard for airlines like Ryanair to bump up the headline prices of their flights. But their costs are going to start to increase. So I don't think that we're going to see the end of this.
I'm not sure about BA. I did fly up to Glasgow recently and did get a little lemon biscuit. And I think it was coffee, Simon.
That's changing. That's changing. BA announced recently that on short haul flights, you're not going to get a free drink and
buy
free snack anymore. Brilliantly, when BA announced this, it also suggested that it had done some form of customer research that suggested this was a good idea, which we commented on in the office of, like, so what kind of customer research consists of saying, excuse me, sir, would you like a free beer? No, I'd like a beer, but I'd like to pay for it instead. You can't do any customer research that ever comes up with that answer. Ever, no, ever, ever.
Fair beer to a lemon biscuit, though.
I flew with BA up to Glasgow recently as well.
Did you get a beer?
And I had a beer, yeah. Did you? What did?
Right.
Didn't they ask you what you wanted to drink?
No.
What time of day was it, Georgie?
It's probably about 9 a.m.
Well, that's why you didn't have a beer.
Editor Simon Lambert, personal first editor Rachel McCard-Strauss.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.